Hi and welcome to our podcast, Kinderanästhesie Talk with Armin and Gordon. Kinderanästhesie Talk means pediatric anesthesia talk. You wouldn't believe that.
Today is Monday, the 1st of April, or Easter Monday, or April's Fool. But don't worry, no jokes today. We are Dr. Armin Sebelewski
and Dr. Gordon Fink.
We are specialists of anesthesiology and we host a German-speaking podcast about pediatric anesthesia.
Our concept is simple. Either we talk to each other about a pediatric anesthesia topic, or we invite experts to talk about a specific topic, for example, a guideline. But Gordon, let's introduce ourselves first. Maybe there are some audience members who are listening to us for the first time.
Yeah, possibly. So go on.
So you are Gordon, the man with the sexy presenter voice. But in real life, apart from this podcast, you currently work as a consultant of pediatric anesthesia at the Vivantes Hospital in Berlin, Friedrichshain. Your main field is pediatric anesthesia, of course, but you are also an emergency doctor.
So are you, Armin. And you're the man who can mumble wonderfully, but we love you anyway. And it was your idea to start this exciting project, actually. So, you're Dr. Armin Sebelewski. You're also a specialist in anesthesiology. You are a pediatric anesthetist. You are an emergency physician. Intensive care medicine is currently your main area of activity. And you are also a researcher. And your research activities are in acute lung injury and in, guess what, pediatric anesthesia. And you currently work at the University Hospital Schleswig-Holstein in Kiel.
Yeah, that's right, Gordon. We've been running this podcast for about 2 years, and our aim was to share our knowledge about pediatric anesthesia. For the few people who are listening to us for the first time, we should briefly explain how we came up to this podcast. Gordon, buddy, can you share your version of our podcast origin story?
You visited me in Berlin, and you told me that there was a move going on at your hospital. The pediatric anesthesiology department has moved from the old building to the new building. And you were able to accompany this move and also gave a lot of thought to how pediatric anesthesia could be modernized there.
Yes, and you, Gordon, gave me lots of advice. And I realized that the topics we are talking about would certainly be very interesting for other ears as well.
And so we decided to simply record our banter. And lo and behold, a whole 2 years later, we realized that a lot of people listen to what we say here.
And for the first 2.5 years, we concentrated on German-speaking listeners. But since anesthesiologists are very well networked all over the world, it was clear that sooner or later we would also do an English language episode. And now the time has come. But initially, you weren't particularly enthusiastic about this idea.
Well, yeah, that's right. Because I thought for such a high-quality project we are producing here, the language skills really need to be almost perfect, and I'm really not an English native speaker, as you can hear.
Yeah, me neither, as you can hear, but I'm ingenious.
But I think that's one of your strengths, Armin.
Oh, thank you.
I think you have to be a little bit crazy and a little bit brave, just like you have to be to work in pediatric anesthesia, right?
Yeah, that's right.
By the way, I just had a thought when you earlier said where you live. I have a special question for you.
Okay.
Do you know an American Hollywood actor who has the same name as the city you actually live in? Any idea?
An actor called Kiel?
Exactly.
I don't know him or her.
I bet you know him from his most famous role.
Shall I give you a hint? Yeah, give me a hint.
Okay. He appears in 2 James Bond movies.
Ah, is it the man with the golden teeth?
Right, yeah, very good. Just okay. First hint. The other were, he died in 2014 and he suffered from acromegaly.
Yeah, that
I
was
guess
a big one.
Now you have known. Yeah. Yeah. His height was 2.14 meters and he played the character of Jaws, the guy with the steel teeth. And his name was Richard Kiel, yeah.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that.
His name was Kiel because his grandparents were immigrants and they came from Kiel.
Oh, good. So my name would be Goslar. But my real name is Sebelewski.
Yeah. And I'm Gordon Salzgitter.
If you don't know where Goslar or Salzgitter is, don't worry. These cities are not the biggest cities in Germany, but very important because we are from these cities.
By the way, Salzgitter is a huge area. So there are many little villages in a very huge area. So this makes it the fifth biggest city in Germany.
Yeah, maybe it will be noted in the next Lonely Planet, Germany. Yeah, but maybe. Let's talk about serious topics, Gordon.
Yeah, Armin, what have you planned for today?
Now, we have brought a very interesting topic today. It's about nothing less than the new airway management guideline for neos and infants. And this episode is in English because we have found two international experts on this topic. And there are Nicola Disma from Italy and Thomas Riva from Switzerland.
From Italy. No need to keep our listeners on the edge of their seats any longer. Let's roll the interview we snagged with those two fellas. Get ready for some insider insights and maybe a sprinkle of uninspected humor. This sounds good.
ChatGPT.
Okay, Armin, let's get serious again. You have an important announcement.
Before we start, we have an important notice for our German-speaking audience. In about 2 weeks, we will release a classic pediatric anesthesia talk with Armin and Gordon in old-fashioned style, where we will discuss this guideline.
All right, here we go. Finally, it's here, the new guideline for airway management in neonates and infants, and we all have been waiting for it for quite a long time. As a podcast on pediatric anesthesia, it's our duty to talk about it and to discuss the contents, but however, since we are a kinder anesthesia talk, that's not enough for us, which is why we're also speaking with two of the authors, Nicola Disma and Thomas Riva, and we are about to discuss the contents with them because it has always been proven to be effective to go directly to the source.
Exactly, Gordon. And now Nicola is smiling in front of us in our screens, and I can hardly believe that is really happening right now that he is here, live from Italy. So hi, Nicola. Thomas will join us later on. He's on call and maybe he's busy right now. Your both names appear in the authorship of guidelines in major pediatric anesthesia studies in the recent years, so as the airway management guidelines we are here today to talk about, the Apricot study, the Nectarine study, and major works on apneic oxygenation in emergency front of neck access, just to name a few of examples. You two guys, thank you so much for being here and taking the time to share your knowledge and experience with us and our audience. Can you, Nicola, give us a short briefing, who you are and where you currently work?
First of all, thank you very much for inviting me. My name is Nicola Disma. I'm Italian. I work in a children's hospital, which is called Istituto Giannina Gaslini, which is located in Genova and is the second largest children's hospital for Italy. We do cover all the specialties, and I'm a pediatric consultant, pediatric anesthesia consultant in this hospital. I'm also associate professor at the university, and I'm part of the European Society of Anesthesia since a long time because I've been the chair of the pediatric anesthesia subcommittee, and I'm currently one of the members of the research committee of the European Society of Anesthesia and Intensive Care. And this is more or less who I am.
And now Thomas Riva joined us.
Can you hear me good or?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, wonderful.
I can hear you good. So, dear Thomas, you joined our interview. Can you give us a little bit more background information about you, short briefing who you are and where you currently work?
First of all, thank you very much for the invitation. My name is Thomas Riva. I'm working in Bern. I'm professor of anesthesia at the University in Bern, and I work as a head of non-operating room anesthesia at the Inselspital in Bern and as a consultant of pediatric anesthesia. And my research field is airway management.
Congratulations for getting professor. That's very fresh news, as far as I know.
Yes, 1 month.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Airway management is a topic that interests so many clinicians providing medical care in children, and recent trials indicate a high incidence of critical events during airway management, especially in neonates. And possibly that's why workshops are regularly fully booked and symposia on airway management in children are always well attended. So here's my question to you, Nicola. Why did it take until 2024 for the first set of guidelines on this topic to be released?
That's a really good question for beginning. Actually, if you remember well, these are not the first guidelines on pediatric airway management, because the Difficult Airway Society produced already a previous guidelines long time ago, which actually remain the most used and most cited guidelines until we published the new guidelines. In 2020, the American Society of Anesthesia wanted to publish the new guidelines on airway management in adults. And actually, we, when I say we, I mean myself and John Fiaggio and some other co-authors from the very same guidelines, were asked to be part of the team and to collaborate in developing the small session on the pediatric airways. So actually, we were involved in the American Society of Anesthesia guidelines. And then once the guidelines were out in 2020, we thought that it was much more important to have our own guidelines rather than being a small section in an adult guidelines. So I think it was a good and wise decision. We were a little bit crazy to jump into this new adventure, but at the end of the day, we were successful and we were able to publish the new guidelines, which I think they are a good product at the end of the day.
So we are talking about the guideline now, and the list of authors read like the lineup for a children's anesthesia world championship, if there were one. So we wonder, how is it possible to reach a consensus in such a large group of experts? Did you argue a lot?
I'm happy to answer this question. Before I answer, actually, I want to give you a little background. If you read the title, is European Society of Anesthesia and Intensive Care and British Journal of Anesthesia Joint Guidelines. What does it mean? It means that immediately after we published the Nectarine paper in the British Journal of Anesthesia, the editor-in-chief of the British Journal approached us and asked to work on a new airway guidelines. We were happy to take the challenge, but actually the British Journal of Anesthesia is not a society, and we thought that it was much more important to work under the umbrella of the European Society of Anesthesia. That's why we asked the Society of Anesthesia and the British Journal to sign an agreement and to work together and to support the development of the new guidelines. So this was the background. And the reason why we choose such a large number of co-authors, it's simply because we wanted to reach geographically all the parts of the world. So actually there are experts from Europe, there are experts from Canada, North America, there are experts from Japan, Australia. So the beauty of this group is that they cover all over the globe. And actually, it was a very important experience because we also had the opportunity to share different ways to work and different ways to approach the pediatric airway. So at the end of the day, we produced a paper, which I think is important, but it was also a moment for us to grow up and to improve our knowledge.
And so it has become finally, as we think, a fantastic piece of work. In order to conduct a structured literature research, you develop so-called PICO questions, which we now gradually delve into. But can you give us first some background information about those PICO questions?
No problem. So the PICO system is the standard way to develop guidelines and systematic reviews. So we used a standard operating procedure, which is standardized by the European Society of Anesthesia, which I think is more or less the same system which has been used for many other guidelines. So basically, the initial idea was to concentrate our efforts on a specific population. So we started thinking about the whole pediatric population, and then we thought that it was too big work. And also we thought that the most fragile part of the pediatric population are neonates and infants. And finally, we also noticed that most of the novel literature on the highway were concentrated on neonates. Let me think about the nectarine study, the difficult highway from the nectarine, and then the results from the PEDI registry and the VISI trials. All these big trials were concentrated on neonates and infants. That's why we wanted to develop guidelines on this very small and fragile population. And then once we decided the population, we developed the PICOS. And of course, there was a lot of discussion among the group because we wanted to cover all the different parts of highway management, from the preoperative part to the intraoperative, the standard intubation, the difficult intubation, and then something which is unique for these guidelines are the extubation part and the impact of human factors. These are all the different PICOS which has been voted, agreed by the group, and then developed through the literature search and the next steps of the standard guidelines. This is more or less the story which is behind developing the PICOS.
Yeah, thank you for the overview. And let's directly start with the first PICO and talk about the first PICO. And the topic is preoperative airway assessment to predict difficulty. Is physical examination the best way to predict difficult airway management?
Actually, there is no evidence that support the physical examination can predict difficult airway management. But if you go at the bed of the patient, if you make a clinical examination, if you look at the medical history, first of all, you think about airway management. You start thinking about airway management. You think what could be our plan as the child, any physiological or anatomical feature that can maybe lead to a difficult intubation. What we can say nowadays is maybe, but if the airway management would be really difficult, you see after the induction of the patient and when you perform the laryngoscopy. Actually, the best parameter for predict difficult airway management would be the percentage of glottic opening. There is unpublished data still that goes in this direction. In neonates, don't help us if you never saw the neonate before. But making a profound and precise physical examination allow you to find out the feature of the patient that may have a micro retrognathia, prognathia, a small mouth opening, and enable you to start thinking about airway management. So you can start performing a plan, you can prepare yourself, you can start preparing the video laryngoscopy, planning with the apneic oxygenation and all the backups plan that you need.
Okay, so the physical examination is good enough to predict the difficult airway, to recognize it. Do you think AI can help us to detect the difficult airway management? So in the future, what do you think?
Actually, we have to define what's difficult. What we know from the Nectarine trial is that neonates is a population with much higher difficult airway compared to normal population. We have up to 6% of the neonates are difficult to intubate. When you look at these difficulties, you see that 50% of these children had a Malampati 1 to 2 and a POGO score bigger than 50%, which actually you won't think they could be difficult. In neonates, we have to define the anatomical difficulties and the physiological difficulties of the child. So AI can help in case of anatomical difficulties, but more than 50% of the neonates are just difficult because they are neonates.
Oh, good answer.
Perfect transition to the next topic, preparation for airway management and pharmacological treatment outside resuscitation. And this is Pico 2. Before airway management, what preparation should be mandatory on your side?
This was a very important, Pico, and most of the preparation and planning was referred to the pharmacological preparation of these children. You will see in the guidelines that we wanted to remark that the use of sedation or general anesthesia is mandatory on the daily clinical practice. You know, tracheal intubation is not something that belongs only to anesthetist, but we are sharing this competence between anesthetist, intensivist, neonatologist, emergency physicians. So all the different kinds of physician, they may have their own competence. However, in 2024, we think that it was important to remark that the use of awake intubation in this specific population should be limited to very few and selected cases. Then the rest of the population deserve appropriate pharmacological management, sedation, general anesthesia, to make the tracheal intubation, which is a very stressful procedure, as much comfortable as it is possible. This was something that we wanted to remark in our guidelines. And I think this was actually achieved, and we stated that the use of general anesthesia is part of the preparation and the planning before starting any kind of management of airway in this population.
If spontaneous breathing is not necessary, is neuromuscular block mandatory?
Yes.
Yes. So may I remark this question? Actually, sometimes it's a matter of semantics. So we have to be very careful. There is nothing mandatory. You have to be confident with your technique, and you have to do what you are used to do for the best care of your child. However, if you base the answer on the literature evidence, there is enough evidence to say that the use of neuromuscular blocking before proceeding to the tracheal intubation make the maneuver easier. So if you are not an expert, but you have experts in the operating room or next door, and you're starting managing the airway, and you want to make in an easier and more comfortable way, and the child has no contraindications, this is really important, so every case has to be considered in a different way, then you can proceed with the neuromuscular block before you attempt laryngoscopy and then intubation. I think, Thomas, you agree with this statement. Of course, there is no one rule that fits every child, but in general, we may say that neuromuscular block improve the success of intubation and make the maneuver easier and more comfortable for the child.
So that's a very important statement on this point, I think.
Okay, Thomas, when was your last intubation?
Today.
And how did you manage the situation? How did you prepare?
We prepare our anesthesia car with all the medication. Today was a quite difficult child with a subglottic stenosis. So was not the standard operation. I had we intubate the child, and then I performed a supraglottic jet ventilation for a laser of a laryngeal cleft. We started with Disoprivan propofol, even though for children so small is not allowed, but as he had to stay apneic or with jet ventilation, we hadn't any other option. So I started with propofol, apneic oxygenation, video laryngoscopy, curved tube, and after the intubation, we extubate the child. We started with supraglottic jet ventilation during laser, and I finished with LMA.
Okay, that was
something
very special case, yeah.
Special for today.
I mean, you didn't see that coming with that question.
No. Okay. But you mentioned the video laryngoscopy, and that leads us to the PICO 3, tracheal intubation.
So now coming up, one of the highlights of this guideline, during tracheal intubation in neonates and infants, is video laryngoscopy or direct laryngoscopy your first choice in use?
There is nowadays enough evidence that shows that video laryngoscopy with standard blade should be the first choice technique for tracheal intubation in neonate and infant. We have the VISI trial, we have the optimized trial that we perform and we published last year that show with enough evidence now that video laryngoscopy enables better first pass success rate. One thing, if I may say, before direct or video laryngoscopy, you must be proficient in back mass ventilation. It's something that we did address in the guidelines, but it's something that as a non-pediatric anesthesiologist intubating children, the most important skill that you have to acquire is back mass ventilation. It's what actually enables us to oxygenate the child before we perform the intubation. Performing the intubation, as I said, nowadays it's quite clear there is enough evidence and is one of the places where actually video laryngoscopy has enough evidence is that neonate and infant should be intubated with a video laryngoscope with standard blade.
What is your favorite standard blade, McIntosh or Miller?
Actually, Miller one.
And for you, Nicola?
Miller for neonates.
I have also the Mach 0.
I also have the Mach 0.
But somehow I prefer the Miller one.
Me too.
Do you have any waits until you use the Miller and from when you use the Mach?
I actually tend to say if the child has teeth, I use the Mach blade.
Oh, okay.
It's a good rule.
But don't ask me the evidence of that.
It works for you, obviously.
Yeah. The problem is that with the video laryngoscope, we actually have the Mach 0 and the Mach 2. I don't have the Mach 1.
Because the Mach 1, I think, doesn't exist for this. For some reason, they did 1, 0, and 2. Yes.
My former chief in Bremen, he had a saying. He said, a short blade is often too short, but a long blade is never too long.
Yeah, that's right.
So he would prefer the longer blade.
That's why I prefer the Miller one, because the Mach 0 is sometimes really short. And with the Miller one, you can come back a little bit and you can intubate.
Nicola, what is the definition of a difficult intubation in neonates and infants? Is it the same as in adults?
That's a really good question. I think one day we should standardize the definition, which is not, unfortunately, today. However, as you remember from the PEDI and from many other publications, a difficult intubation is defined as a Cormac-Lehane score beyond 3 or 4, POGO score less than 50%, the easiest way to define difficult intubation is multiple attempts, more than 2 attempts of direct laryngoscopy. However, as Thomas said, I think that neonates, even the normal neonate, the small one, is difficult by itself because it's a completely different population. It's very small. He has his own metabolism. He has his own anatomy of airway. And of course, last but not least, we don't have enough neonates for being all experts. So of course, the exposure we have to the neonatal case is relatively rare. For example, I always work with fellows and residents, and I can't remember the last time I intubated a neonate. Actually, I was always there supervising my fellows. And again, there are not enough neonates for being all experts. So neonates are difficult by definition. And then on top of this, we have the super difficult neonates, which are those with syndrome, with craniofacial syndrome, with anatomical abnormalities, and all the other problems related to the airway and the lungs. These are all difficult patients.
I bet we're all familiar with this old discussion, what kind of tube to use, cuffed or uncuffed. So, Thomas, what's your criteria to choose either one or the other?
Also, above 3 kilos, we use cuffed tube always. Under 2 kilos, 2.5 kilos, we use uncuffed tube. And between 2.5 and 3 kilos is up to the intervention, up to the child, up to difficulty of lung situation. But we tend to use a microcuff tube whenever possible.
And what route do you prefer, Nicola, oral or nasal?
For us, in my institution, we do have, maybe it's not the usual practice, but we do all nasal intubation in neonates. And below the weight of 5 kilos, we use uncuffed tube. This is simply because it makes the tube a little bit more stable if intubated through the nose, and because I think it's much easier to deliver oxygen through the same tube if you're using apneic oxygenation. However, if you base the answer on the evidence, you may say that there is no evidence that cuffed is better than uncuffed or vice versa, then it means that if properly used, the tube are both equally safe. So you can, so the magic rule does not exist. You can use either cuffed or uncuffed. It's important that you use in a proper way.
Okay, you mentioned the apneic oxygenation. Can you give us a definition about that? What is apneic oxygenation?
Apneic oxygenation actually is the passive application of oxygen in an apneic patient. It's the diffusion of oxygen from the upper airway through the larynx, reaching the trachea per diffusion. Actually, it's not a new concept. It's a concept that was described the first time by Follard and Meltzer more than 100 years ago. And now it's something that is having a hype. But as we could demonstrate in our systematic review, by applying apneic oxygenation, particularly in the small, in infant and neonate, you can increase the percentual of first pass success rate.
Yeah, in my perception, it is a hype as well, but it extends the safe apnea time. And how do you handle the apneic oxygenation in your hospital, Thomas? How do you perform the apneic oxygenation on infants?
It depends. If the child is on high flow, I use a high flow as 2 liters per kilo per minute of heated and humidified air. If it's just a normal neonate coming in operation theater, I use normal nasal cannulas with 1 liter per kilo per minute. If we use the nasal route for the intubation, if we intubate the child nasally, we use a nasal sponge on the other nerves, and we give 1 liter per kilo per minute.
Oh, Gordon, I'm quite content to make it like an expert.
Maybe you are also an expert.
No, I'm not. Not as Nicola and Thomas.
You guys, what do you think? Is a neonatal and infant tracheal intubation algorithm necessary? Or, expressed in other words, which aids do you think are useful?
We developed, actually, in our guidelines, a cognitive aid for neonatal intubation. And if you remember, actually, the cognitive aid is divided into different colors. It's green, yellow, and red. And, of course, the idea that we wanted to reinforce was that the situation is never static, but it's always dynamic. It means that you could be on the green part of the cognitive aid. And, of course, if the situation changes, then you pass through the yellow and the red part. And, of course, if you manage properly, you come back to the red part of the algorithm. So, basically, what guides you is not only what you are doing, but basically how the patient is responding to your treatment. This is something really good. So it's the patient that is guiding you and is guiding your decision. We also wanted to add a couple of very important points. One is the concept of limiting the number of attempts, which is really important. Stop keeping attempts, because this increases linearly the risk of having a serious complication. And in the very last part of the algorithm, we also wanted to add the concept of debriefing and discussing always what happened and learning from our errors. So this is more or less the cognitive aid. Of course, we didn't want to reinvent the wheel because there are already very good cognitive aids. I'm thinking about the Vortex, which is probably the most famous. And more or less, our algorithm replicates in somehow the concept of the Vortex.
So this would be a good seek to the topic human factors, but we're getting to this later. Our next topic is PICU 4. What should be the gold standard to manage an anticipated difficult airway, and who should be involved?
At least our strategy is to deal with these particular children with two pediatric anesthesiologists. Enabling the team to intubate, not just Thomas Riva or my colleague, but to be a team that performed the intubation. And that is actually something that with the video laryngoscopy is very important. You can make the intubation a teamwork and not a singular person intubation that look through the mouth like with the direct laryngoscopy. For me, this is one of the most important things. If you can make the intubation teamwork, that should be actually, for me, the gold standard in anticipated difficult airway. And what should be the gold standard actually is we know that video laryngoscopy should actually be used instead of direct laryngoscopy. The first pass success rate in difficult airway management with video laryngoscopy is 10 times higher than direct laryngoscopy. At that point, you have to decide do we need to administer a neuromuscular block? Do we need to keep the patient in spontaneous breathing? Should we do with a video laryngoscopy? Should we do that with fiber optic intubation? There is actually no one-fits-all recept.
That's my favorite sentence in this chapter.
And where, besides emergency intubation, so a planned elective intubation, where's your first choice location to perform this?
Operating room. So, of course, the more diplomatic answer is the place where you have enough expertise around and enough equipment ready and available for your plan A and plan B and plan C. But again, coming back to my original answer, the operating room, I think, is the safest place where you have all the things that I listed around you. Actually, sometimes we are called to perform intubation in the emergency department, in the ICU, and that is the place where it's much more difficult to teach our residents, because you are not in a familiar place, and you don't have everything handy, everything available, and that is the place where you as a consultant have to perform the maneuver and reduce the level of teaching. But if I have to decide in an elective case, this is actually, for example, what we do when we do laryngotracheal reconstruction. We do in the operating room, and then the child is transferred to the ICU. And then when there is time to extubate the child or to change the tube, the child comes back to the operating room, and we perform the maneuver in the operating room. This is the place where I think is the safest place for doing such kind of complicated maneuvers.
When did you have your last difficult airway in Neos, Nicola? And how did you manage the situation? Thomas already told us about this last situation, which was obviously today.
Actually, I have to be honest that a couple of weeks ago, we received an infant who had an history of esophageal atresia and something on the trachea. So actually, they did surgery on the esophagus, but there was some surgery performed also in the trachea. But there was no medical history, because this child came back from another hospital, from another country, and we lost most of the information related to the kind of surgery. So actually, we started anesthesia in spontaneous breathing, and the plan was for gastroscopy, because it was planned to have esophageal dilatation. And the plan, of course, was for tracheal intubation. And then the glottis, the view of the glottis was optimal, really good, but I couldn't pass the size for a tube. And then I tried with a size 3. And then I tried with a size 2.5. None of these tubes were able to pass. And actually, we discovered that the trachea was patent, but it was tortuous. So there was some tracheal reconstruction. And the only way to perform the intubation was using a combined technique with the video laryngoscopy and rigid bronchoscopy. Actually, it was a surprise. The good part of the story is that the airways was always patent and the child was always in a good physiological condition. We were able to ventilate and oxygenate the child properly. So we were in the position of awakening the child and bringing back to the world and decide for a better plan. But actually, physical condition of the child was always excellent, and we were in a comfortable position of deciding what to do next. That's why we decided for the rigid bronchoscopy. It was a semi-nightmare, because actually the end of the story was okay, and the intubation was successful, and then the child went well.
Yeah. Once again, I want to cite my favorite sentence of the guidelines. And there is no one solution fits all for difficult airway management for neonates and infants. And that's what you experience also with your child.
So if you don't have a difficult intubation and you think you succeeded the intubation, how do you confirm the correct positioning of the tube? What's your technique?
Entidal CO2.
Clear answer, Nicola?
I agree that entidal CO2, because physical examination is not enough, especially if you have a complex child. Of course, it's part of the puzzle, but you need entidal CO2 to confirm. And actually, in very, very complex cases, we do a second look with the video laryngoscopy in order to have a team confirmation the tube is in the correct position. Of course, there are new techniques which are coming, like ultrasound, X-ray. Probably the ultrasound is an interesting technique which could apply more routinely in very complex cases.
Do you use ultrasound, and what do you want to see? Do you want to see the tube, or do you want to see the lungs inflating, or what do you want to see with ultrasound?
I think you can do both, because if the child is small, you can see the tube in the trachea, performing an ultrasound above the trachea. But actually, you can see if both lungs are equally expanding, are equally ventilating. It's a technique that now is ready available, and you don't need to forget that you can use ultrasound if you need an extra confirmation of the correct tracheal intubation.
How about old school auscultation? I guess you auscultate your child in both lungs, do you?
Yes, but not to confirm the position of the tube, just to confirm that I'm ventilating both lungs. For me, the confirmation of the tube is end tidal CO2, direct view of the tube passing the vocal cords, or fibroscopy through the tube to confirm that you are in trachea.
And let's get to the next PICO, strategies for tracheal extubation.
Intubation is a skill. Extubation is an art. This was a podcast episode released 2 years ago, so our audience knows what we're talking about. And what is the best strategy for safe extubation in neonates and infants after difficult intubation, either anticipated or unanticipated?
For me, the best strategy is to remember that extubation must be always planned. You don't need to extubate the child at any cost. And that's the first thing that you have to think about. Intubation is a must because you can have severe problems, but extubation is a maybe for me. And there you have to be ready with everything as if you would have a difficult intubation. Without this preparation, you shouldn't even try to extubate the child. For the place, I would say wherever you feel comfortable, wherever you have expertise and all the needed equipment. And for the strategy, I would go 99% of the time for an awake extubation if you had a difficult intubation.
Or maybe 99.9?
Yeah.
So same criteria you use for the extubation of a difficult airway as you use for the anticipated difficult intubation.
Yeah, and to make it clear, let's imagine a setting. You had an infant with a difficult airway, and the intubation was performed at 2 p.m. You had a long surgery, and it's now 8 p.m. in the evening, and the resident anesthetist is, of course, unavailable because he got COVID or something like that, and he cannot be replaced. So the child is transferred to the intensive care unit. Where would you extubate this child, in the operating room or at the ICU? Or would you wait until tomorrow for a daytime extubation?
What kind of surgery?
Pooh. I haven't thought about it. Let's say removal of
abdominal tumor.
Okay, so coming back to what Thomas said, there's no need to rush any extubation. So again, if there are enough expertise around, so the child had a tumor, tumor removal, and on top of this, a difficult intubation. Do you have enough expertise around you at 8 p.m. to extubate this child after long surgery? If yes, then you can proceed, of course. You can proceed in an awake child. Be sure that you waived your child from any sedatives or anesthetic. There are no residual of neuromuscular block. All the standard rules. And then if you have enough expertise and you have the same equipment that you've used for intubation ready, available, then you can proceed extubation. This is in general the rule. I remember that a few years ago I wrote a nice editorial, which actually was one of my best editorials, The Ends of the Movie Matters. So don't forget that 50% of the highway accident occurs at the time of landing, not taking off. So landing is a risky time, and you have to plan well in advance what to do before removing the tube from a trachea.
Okay, because intubation is a skill and extubation is an art.
So we all agree that the extubation of a child with a difficult airway should be awake. But what is your standard with an uncomplicated airway? What's your standard extubation? Is it under deep anesthesia or when the child is awake?
Deep for me.
Awake.
Good.
Armin, what's your standard?
Lemon face.
Awake. Awake. Super awake. Yeah. And what about you, okay. Gordon?
I prefer deep, but I also extubate a deep child and change the airway to an LMA. And then I'm waiting for spontaneous breathing with the child at the LMA.
Okay, interesting.
And then sometimes children extubate themselves. But this is not by accident, but for me by purpose. Because when they're awake, they can pull out the LMA by themselves.
Yeah, I do contrary. With LMA, I always extubate deep.
That's interesting. For anesthetists, yeah. Four opinions.
Okay, but when you say that removing the airway device in deep anesthesia minimizes the airway complications, then maybe you can tell us on which factors this decision depends, deep versus awake.
So it is basically the experience. This is something that guides you in what to do and when to extubate the child. And it depends also on the kind of surgery, on the medical history of the child. But basically, you should know that if you remove a supraglottic highway or a tracheal tube under deep anesthesia, you reduce the risk of coughing and laryngospasm. Of course, you increase a little bit the risk of airway obstruction, but all the dynamic complications like bronchospasm, laryngospasm, are minimized if the child is deep. So I always prefer moving any device in a deep child, especially if this child had an airway surgery. This is even more important because, for example, for tonsillectomy, the larynx is very irritated by the surgery and you need to remove the tube when the child is still deep. Otherwise, you risk having a serious laryngospasm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's address the last chapter. It's human factors. And we were happy to hear that the human factors found their place in these guidelines. Why have you decided to include this topic into the guidelines?
Neonates are still intubated by human. It's not, there is some rumors that robotic intubation may be possible, but nowadays it's still humans that intubate neonates, and factors like anchoring, like fixation, like bed preparation have a big importance or like a big impact on the result of the intubation. And in the group, we thought that that's something that should be addressed in a guidelines.
Mm. Whose initiative was it to take the human factors into the guidelines in the group?
I think we all agreed on this.
It actually was a group discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but actually you notice that the guidelines, that the part of human factors is not a proper guidelines, but it's more a small scoping review, where we went through all the human factors that they may impact successful airway management. Yeah.
Thomas, can you tell us something about your last fixation error, if you had one?
Maybe yesterday. I was doing a Shamrock block, a plexus lumbalis block. It was quite difficult, and I had to make 4 punctions to get to the, which actually is fairly high, but there wasn't any other person in hospital that could do a plexus lumbalis block. Actually, I had to puncture 4 times, which actually is not my standard. Usually I tend after 2 failed punction to change the operator. And the same is in airway management.
What about you, Nicola? Do you remember your last fixation error?
Fixation error, probably I do every day. Because, I mean, the more senior you became, the more at risk you are at doing fixation errors. Because, you know, the around fixation, there's also a problem of leadership, respect from other people. So we have the fear of failing the procedure. And then we forget that sometimes we should stop doing things, we should hand over to someone else. Even if your colleague is younger or more junior than you, it could be a little bit more fresh than you because you are stressed and you are tired, you did many things at the same time. You ended your interview, your podcast late in the night and you were tired. So for the future, we all should remember that fixation is not good for the patient. And sometimes it should stop early rather than late, which is the best for the patient.
Nicola, we all know what you are talking about. Thomas, you told us something very interesting. Neos are still intubated by humans. Do you expect in the future a Da Vinci intubation?
No. I mean, with this system, no. Okay. I mean, the physiology of neonates does not... I mean, there was Da Vinci intubation.
Really?
Yes. In adults,
okay.
But they had so long that I cannot imagine Da Vinci intubation. But I can imagine, actually I'm aware of software, that they can be implemented in video of the video laryngoscope and can help people to recognize anatomical structure, can address the intubator to push more, to pull more, and at the end, they recognize if the tube is in place or not.
Yeah, interesting idea. Yeah. Something like a joystick for intubation, an advanced video laryngoscope with feedback mechanism.
There is something, not for children. Actually, they are prototype, but not yet used in humans. Actually, the next step will be to implement AI software in the videos of our video laryngoscope.
Interesting research field. But for the moment, we humans, we still have to intubate the children by ourselves. And for an optimal intubation, we have this great guideline that we talked about. And I think we went through all the chapters. Gordon, what do you think? Do we have still any questions?
I have no more questions, no. It has been a very intense and fascinating last hour, and I'm really happy that you guys gave us the opportunity to do this interview with you. So thank you so much for spending your time with us.
Yeah, thank you so much. Also
thank
from my side.
Thank you very much for inviting us. My last remark is that you know that we jumped into this new adventure, which is a multinational, international, multicontinental study, which is the cricket. We thought that we were enough crazy for writing that the guidelines, but actually now we discovered that we are even more crazy with the cricket study. So I hope we can reconjoin in the future and discuss altogether the result of the 100,000 patients included into the cricket study if they happen. Anyway, this is the next challenge.
All right, we're happy to meet you guys again and talk about the cricket study. But for now, where can we gather more information?
Actually, we do have the website, which is cricketstudy.eu, where you can discover all the information.
Yeah, we'll make a link from this episode.
Thank you very much. Homepage. Fantastic.
Thomas, last words for you.
Thank you very much for inviting me, actually. And I joined Nicola in advising to try to participate to this even crazier adventure. I don't know if we can say crazy because it's actually it's guidelines as nothing compared to the cricket study.
Good luck for this project. But before we come to an end, let us tell you about our tradition. We collect donations from our listeners and we pay our fixed costs from it, but the rest of the money we don't keep for ourselves. We donate our donations to organizations that are close to our hearts. Mostly they are medical organizations related to children. So we would like to know from you now, is there any organization you would like to make us a donation to in your name to say thank you for spending your time with us?
I could have one idea. We have a Pflege assistant. I don't know in English. Assistant of care. In Bern, he works as a Pflege assistant at the intensive care. And is a hospital director in Rwanda or Burundi. And there, he developed an hospital. As Inselspital, we donated some ambulance, we donated all the monitor, and maybe it could be nice. It's not an organization, it's a person who actually is directing the hospital in Africa, and this one where we know that all the money that are donated are put in the hospital and not in bureaucracy or something like that.
Sounds very good. Okay, so maybe you give us a contact.
Sounds like he builds up something very big. And we can motivate him maybe with a little donation from our side.
I will send you the contact of him and the website.
And Nicola, if you don't have an idea right now.
I think I support what Thomas said. I'm happy to give the contribution to this guy. I really trust on this, and I think concentrating just one donation rather than splitting into two donations would be much more effective.
Perfect. He's our man.
Thank you very much, and good night, good evening. As we say in Germany, tschüss.
Auf Wiederhören.
Ciao, arrivederci.
Ciao, Zeme, from Bern.
So that was the interview. We really hope you enjoyed it. Are you happy with it, Gordon?
I thought it was great, but I'm so glad it's over now.
Oh, me too, yeah. And all the tension fell away, yeah.
But let's get over to our concept again. This podcast is 100% financially independent. There are no cooperation contracts and there's no advertising. Our work is donation-based and we appreciate every listener who values our work and supports us with a contribution.
If you want to support us, go to our website www.kinderanästhesie-talk.de. As we already explained to Nicola and Thomas, we do not keep the money for ourselves. We pay our fixed costs from it, yeah, and the rest is passed on to charitable organizations that are close to our hearts and have a connection to children or pediatric medicine.
That's right. You can do a donation via the QR code on our website. Even if you don't have a PayPal account, apart from a donation, we also appreciate your rating on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us.
Yeah, and that's it at this point. We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you would like to get in touch with us, please send us a message either by email or via social media. You can find our addresses and accounts on our website, as I mentioned. By the way, Gordon, when we started this podcast, we have never thought that Kinderanästhesie Talk would sound a bit awkward in English, don't you think?
Well, I believe that the German language itself basically sounds very strange to the people. I mean, you can say, hallo, es ist total schön, dich wiederzusehen. Wir haben uns lange nicht gesehen. Ich habe dich vermisst. Du siehst fantastisch aus. And this sounds like as if we were saying, get out of my way, you cannot park here, clear the bike path, or I'll pull you out of your car and I'll give you a thrashing. And actually we're saying, hi, we haven't seen each other for such a long time. It's great to see you again. You look great. Have you lost weight?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a hard language, yeah.
It's a very hard language, yeah.
Yeah, but maybe we need a second name. Bruce Wayne and Peter Parker had another name too.
Did
and,
they?
And since we opened the door to the English speaking community, maybe we should rethink our name or add a second one, like Peter Parker and Bruce Wayne.
Okay, well, let's say we are open to your suggestions. But for now, at this point, there is nothing left to say goodbye to our audience in our traditional way. And this is Auf Wiederhören.
Auf Wiederhören.